Stuart?
Yep.
Okay, we can hear you clearly. I guess probably the best way to start this off is if you could introduce yourself and the organization you are part of.
Sure. My name's Stuart Hammond. I'm currently in Vancouver, and I'm a member of a group called Haiti Solidarity BC, which is a local affiliate of the Canada Haiti Action Network, which is a nationwide kind of information and action network of lots of local Haiti solidarity groups across the country.
Thanks, Stuart. I was wondering if maybe we could start this interview off by having you describe Canada's role in Haiti since the earthquake.
Well, Canada's role since the earthquake has been, I think the Canadian government's role has been to send a great deal of military to Haiti. I think it's about 2,000, it might be more than 2,000 troops were sent down and bolstering the U.S.'s massive influx of military as well. Interestingly, Canada decided not to send its urban search and rescue teams, which, you know, if you hear about the massive destruction at Port-au-Prince, the task that was needed a week ago when this, or over a week ago when this earthquake happened, the task needed was to dig people out of collapsed buildings. So that urban search and rescue team would have been ideally suited for that. But Lawrence Cannon told those teams to stand down and send in the army instead. That's been Canada's main contribution.
Do you know the rationale behind that particular choice?
Well, this is the real question and really something we're going to have to watch over the coming months. I mean, there's been a few explanations offered. One of them, drawing on the U.S. side of things, is that this is a PR opportunity for both countries, the military of both countries, to show that they can play a humanitarian or peacekeeping role in the world. Another thing to consider, though, is that Haiti has been under military occupation since the coup against Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 2004. It's had about a 9,000-person-strong UN military force. And the U.S.'s own analysis of the situation, this was put out by the General Accounting Office in the United States, was that not only is UN occupation cheaper, but there's just less opposition to that compared to direct U.S. military occupation. So I was really shocked to see the U.S. now pouring more troops than the U.N. has in Haiti. But it could be that this earthquake has provided an opportunity for them to assert direct military control of Haiti in a far less controversial way, or a way that is under the cloak of the earthquake, there's less opposition. And Canada's role in Haiti since 2004 has really been sort of the junior partner of the United States, sort of the role that Britain took on with the Iraq War. That's basically the role that Canada has been playing alongside the U.S. So I think in this case, Canada is just following the American lead.
You described Canada as kind of the junior partner. Can you elaborate on what that would look like on the ground?
Sure. Well, I mean, at the present time, I mean, the Canadian military force is, of course, just much smaller than the U.S. presence. But Canada has taken, whose reputation, I think, is still considered better than the U.S., although I was in Haiti a little while before the earthquake, and certainly Haitians are very aware of Canada and regard Canada far less favorably. But what Canada would do would take the lead in organizing some aspects of Haitian society. So, for example, the April 2009 elections, which excluded the Aristide-Lavalas party, Canada took a major role in organizing those and funding them, although the U.S. also paid for the bulk of them. And the upcoming February 28th election, which I presume will be canceled now because of the earthquake, which also excluded Lavalas, which is Haiti's most popular political party, Canada was also in charge of organizing those as well. Canada also, since 2004, has had the RCMP in Haiti training the Haitian National Police. So, you know, in all those types of ways, Canada was sort of following on the U.S.'s agenda in Haiti, which was to basically destroy the Levelouse movement in those kinds of ways, so organizing elections, training the Haitian National Police, etc.
And how is this perceived by the Haitians? And you mentioned you were in Haiti. I'm sure people communicated their perceptions of Canada's role in Haiti to you.
Right. Well, you know, I've traveled a little bit in the world, and generally I find that people are fairly ignorant of Canada. So, you know, in Japan they might be able to say, oh, you guys have great mountains and things like that. But the Haitians, on the other hand, were able to identify very, very specific aspects of Canadian policy and aspects they didn't like. To give you an example, the April 2009 elections, which people were still absolutely outraged about, Haitians would say things like, your ambassador to Haiti, Jill Rivard, came out and initially kind of criticized the elections for excluding Levelouse, but then went ahead and paid for them and accepted their results as totally legitimate. So Haitians can really point out specific things about Canada. And the other thing that Haitians can point out is they list Canada, along with the U.S. and France, as the countries that really organized the 2004 coup d'etat against Aristide.
You've mentioned Aristide and Levelouse and how Canada was complicit in dismantling Levelouse. Can you elaborate for our listeners, I guess, who the Levelouse movement are and who Aristide is?
Sure. Okay. Well, the Levelouse movement came together first when Haiti had its first real democratic election in 1990. Sort of the world, the Haitian elites and the U.S. and other countries sort of expected a guy named Marc Bazin, who was, I think, a former World Bank economist. They sort of just expected that he would win the election. But what happened is they sort of overlooked a peasant and urban poor, which is the majority of the Haitian population, had organized themselves into this movement. And at the last minute, they chose a candidate named Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was a liberation theologist priest. And they won a resounding victory in those elections. And people and the Haitian elite were just immediately and totally stunned and taken aback by this. That was in 1990. In 1991, there was a really violent coup against Aristide in the Levelouse movement. And thousands were killed, and the army took over Haiti. And finally, Aristide was very controversially restored to power by Clinton, in part to stem a large number of Haitians trying to flee to the United States because conditions were so bad under the coup regime. But the condition they imposed on Aristide was to impose austerity measures on Haiti, and he really balked at doing this. And then Aristide was elected again in 2000, and then there was another coup in 2004. And this time, the U.S. Marines directly and Canadian troops were in Haiti at this time as well. Basically, I guess we would say renditioned, but Haitians say kidnapped Aristide and brought him to the Central African Republic. And since that day, since the past 5 years, Aristide's been living in exile in South Africa. He's still very, very popular in Haiti. There are rallies held for him and for the Levelouse movement all the time. We saw one of them on January 1st. There was a massive one on December 16th, 2009. That was the 19th anniversary of Aristide's first election, 1990. So he remains a very, very popular figure. He's a figure who could really mobilize the poor of Haiti if he returned home. And he just recently, after the earthquake, said from South Africa, yeah, I'd like to go back to Haiti and help. And that is something that the U.S. and Canada are absolutely terrified that would happen, because that would really involve them kind of losing control of Haiti's agenda if Aristide was back in the country.
Can you elaborate on that point and also describe You said you mentioned you saw protests in support of Aristide and Lavalas. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on what those looked like?
Well, Haitian protests are extremely, extremely lively. I really wonder if Canadian protests were that fun, if we would have more and they'd be more effective. But the particular protest we saw was held in front of the OAS, the Organization of American States, their office in Haiti in Port-au-Prince, and was targeted at specifically having the OAS not recognize the February 28, 2010 planned elections, which were going to exclude Lavalas. People had signs that said things like, U.S., Canada, don't fund this electoral masquerade. And so, and there's always a few signs of people calling for Aristide to return. I should say the much larger demonstration on the December 16th, I was not in Haiti for that, but that was much more targeted at calling for Aristide's return. As to the decision to really exclude Lavalas, I mean, people can get a sense of that. Just look at any of the Canadian mainstream press or U.S. mainstream press and look what they say about Aristide. Now, this is the most popular political figure in Haiti, someone that the people constantly rally to have back. But look what they say about him. They say things like, well, he's controversial, or, well, his return will cause instability. Well, that's true. He is controversial, and he probably would cause instability if he returned because he's so hated by the Haitian, very, very powerful, but very small Haitian elite. Aristide's program, which is very much based on his own liberation theology, or that's how he articulates it, but the Lavalas program is for dignified poverty. So it's just for a slight redistribution of wealth in Haiti, for higher minimum wages, and things like that, which are very, very threatening, both to the Haitian elite and also to the U.S. and Canada. We can look to the nearby country of Honduras, where the coup against Zelaya was also precipitated by an attempt to raise the minimum wage. In a way, although the story of Haiti has a lot of differences from Honduras, it's very, very similar. They're both very, very poor countries that kind of set the floor, the lowest minimum wage in the region. And for that, Aristide has many other, and Lavalas has many other policies that make them popular with the people, including supporting education and health care. But, you know, that minimum wage alone, threatening to raise that, is one of the real concrete reasons that the U.S. and Canada and the Haitian elite despise Aristide.
What is the minimum wage in Haiti, and what does that provide for people?
It's not a living wage. It turns out to be very complicated to figure it out, and it's a little misleading. Haiti uses a currency called gourdes, and there were attempts to raise the minimum wage recently. There were propositions by kind of civil society to raise it to about 200 gourdes. 200 gourdes a day, I believe, which is approximately, I think, about $5 a day. And Haiti, it should be said, is actually an extremely expensive place to live. Some of the prices are remarkably close to what you'd find in Canada. So you can imagine how difficult it would be to live on that kind of salary. Actually, the parliament and Préval, the current president, vetoed that, raising the minimum wage that high. And we couldn't get an exact figure when we were down there, but it would seem to be closer to about 125 gourdes a day. Although, you know, union leaders and others told us, well, you know, they probably, that's not enforced, so it's probably even lower. So closer to maybe $2 or $3 US a day. The further problem there in determining the minimum wage is that the Haitian elite actually kind of controls the currency rate between the U.S. dollar and the gourde. So even if you say the minimum wage in Haiti is 125 gourdes a day or higher, what really matters is how it is fixed to the U.S. dollar, and that can easily drop in value quite quickly. But Haitians are forced to buy food. You know, essentially, their food is pegged to the U.S. dollar. basically, I mean, the clearest picture I could offer is that the minimum wage in Haiti is extremely low. People make do on maybe $1, $2, $3 U.S. dollars a day, and that's just extremely difficult for them to make a living. What Haitians really depend on to survive is remittances from the U.S. and Canada, the massive Haitian diaspora in the U.S. and Canada. And one of the real compounding problems here, besides this horrible earthquake, is that with the economic crisis in our country, most Haitians living here are not living in privileged positions. They're working marginal jobs to begin with, and it's been extremely difficult for them to continue sending money home. So that's something we heard, Bill Gates and I was on, heard when we were down in Haiti, was we've seen, people told us, we've seen our funds totally dry up, and that concretely means our kids can't afford to go to school anymore, for example, or we can't afford to eat as well. So the Haitian economy, it's dependent on a lot of factors, and in fact, so just learning the minimum wage rate alone doesn't tell you the whole story. You also have to understand what where the Haitian loot is compared to the U.S. dollar, and also look at the huge remittance economy.
I want to get back to talking about Aristide a little bit. You mentioned that he's feared by both the Haitian elites as well as Canadian and American business interests. How would his return, I guess, theoretically impact Canadian and U.S. Business interests?
Well, you know, it's interesting because Aristide has said that he doesn't want to run for president again. He could, I suppose, but we asked a lot of Haitians that. You know, we said, look, if Aristide comes back, like you're asking for, I mean, what role would he play? And what I've come to understand or come to believe is that Aristide's return to the country is a sort of, his physical return would be of great symbolic importance. It would, the fact that he would be able to be in Haiti again would just symbolize a kind of truce between the poor majority in Haiti and the elite and foreign powers. And that it would be a symbol that they would have to listen to the demands of the poor and start paying more for jobs and start investing more in education and all those things. So that's sort of the threat. It's not that Aristide's going to come back and take over the country or anything like that. It's a symbol of the kind of relationship and sharing of power that would occur in Haiti if Aristide returned. And of course, Aristide would be able to speak out if he was in the country, and he certainly would do so. So that's really the great threat. U.S., Canada, and the Haitian elite want to run the entire show, and they don't want to have to share any power. Even the Haitian people don't ask for very much. They ask what people tell us again and again. We want health care. We want schools for our kids, education, and we want to be making a living wage. It's not exactly a radical demand at the level of an idea, although in practice it turns out to be an extremely radical demand to make on these Western powers and on the Haitian elite.
You mentioned that Haiti's been under occupation for quite a while, starting with the UN occupation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what kind of impact that had on social movements and grassroots organizing and lava loss.
Yeah, Haiti had a coup in 2004, and then between 2004 and 2006, there was a coup regime in place. The UN sort of came in midway between 2000 and in about 2005. Their presence, some extent, calm things from the initial brutality of the coup. I mean, the initial coup regime was extremely brutal in its crackdowns. But the UN has really continued the coup crackdown less brutally, but still quite brutally, under the auspices of crushing gangs in urban neighborhoods in Port-au-Prince, specifically the neighborhoods of Cité Soleil, right on the coast, and another neighborhood called Bel Air. The UN has gone in with helicopter gunships, with heavily armed vehicles, and with rifles, and claim to be cracking down on gangs. Now, the gang issue in Haiti is very complicated. There are gangs in the kind of sense that Canadians would recognize, kind of drug gangs, but most gangs are actually kind of neighborhood defense gangs that protect the neighborhood. But the UN has gone down into those neighborhoods and just opened fire. And the thing is, these neighborhoods are so flimsily built that even if the UN was just claimed to be targeting gang members, which is difficult to imagine from what we heard, any kind of stray bullets just rip into these buildings. And we, our delegation is there to take testimony from people, just women, old men, and young men who had been shot by the UN. And the UN does not go into, say, Pétionville and, you know, try and arrest the Haitian elite or crack down on any of them. I mean, those people in society can travel freely. An example is Yves Philippe, who led the coup, one of the military leaders, paramilitary leaders, who led the coup in 2004. I mean, he operates in Haiti totally openly. He was actually going to be allowed to run in this February election. The UN, on the other hand, has just targeted these Lavalau strongholds in the city, and has really cracked down on them and forced a lot of their leaders to operate very, very carefully. So it's had a very, very chilling effect on organizing in those Lavalau neighborhoods. The UN also sort of just provides another layer of veneer of legitimacy to the current Haitian government and to things like these elections that exclude Lavalau. So on January 8th, 4 days before the earthquake, Hedi Anabi, who was killed in the January 12th earthquake, he was the head of the UN in Haiti, just said the UN is going to provide full logistical and security support for the February elections because we want Haitians to make a free and fair choice. And he made no mention of the fact that the most popular political party in Haiti had been excluded. So the UN is definitely playing a role of compounding the attempts to quash the Lavalau movement, both militarily and also politically.
Thanks, Stuart. We've seen an influx of at least 10,000 U.S. troops, 2,000 Canadian troops. How is this going to impact those social movements? And can you elaborate on this rhetoric of security that we've also seen appearing in the media to justify the current military presence?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think we just have to watch this massive influx of troops very closely. I mean, I have to say, I did not see this happening. I really thought the UN, the U.S. rather, had given up trying to occupy Haiti directly, and I was just, I've been totally stunned to see them move in such great numbers, and the same is to be said for Canada. They can only compound the role that UN has already been playing. I mean, the U.S. has just had such a horrible influence on Haiti. I mean, literally, the CIA and other aspects of the U.S. in terms of targeting people, I'm extremely concerned. Like, I literally think that some Lavalau leaders are going to be killed just sort of under the auspices of security. So I think that's just going to be something really to watch and to be careful about. I just don't know when are they going to leave. I mean, this is something we've seen all over the world that, you know, it's very easy to get troops into Iraq and Afghanistan, and it takes years and years and years for them to depart. So this is just something your listeners should really just keep tracking. The U.S. has already occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934. U.S. troops, every time they've landed in Haiti, it's basically been to cause problems and to destroy, in the case of 1994 and also 2004, to destroy or attack or control the Lavalau movement. And, you know, Canada playing this kind of military role is a bit newer. Again, this is really 2004 onward. I think you have to be looked at as this junior partner role, but this is something people really need to keep their attention fixated on. This is just a really, really bad new development in the history of Haiti.
And the discourse on security?
Yeah, this turns out to be really complicated. So I got back from Haiti 4 days before the earthquake. I got back on January 8th. When I was down there, the NGOs in Haiti had already adopted something similar to you'd see in Baghdad, a red zone, green zone model to the city of Port-au-Prince. Basically, Petionville, the rich neighborhood, was the green zone, and all of Port-au-Prince, the whole thing, was the red zone. I mean, I heard some people, some NGO workers and other people in Haiti joking about this. I mean, to be fair to a lot of the NGO workers, very frustrating. If you go to Haiti to help people, again, this is before the earthquake, and then you're not allowed by your organization to actually go to any of the neighborhoods where people need help, or you're only allowed to do so under very particular circumstances with the proper types of security, it's a very, very frustrating thing. And so this aspect of Haiti has actually only been expanded now after the earthquake. The problem with it is that Haiti is not a very dangerous country. If you look at the crime statistics, I mean, compared to, say, the Dominican Republic or, you know, the big cities in Brazil, I mean, Haiti, or even Jamaica, Haiti is extremely, extremely safe. The Haitian people are extremely proud and very, very vocal. And, you know, NGO workers and now I think the people going down for this disaster relief, if you go down there with no understanding of Haitian history, if you go down there with no Creole or even no French, you're going to probably fear going into these slums and other places. And, you know, we've heard stories of the Haitians getting angry that people aren't helping them and stacking dead bodies in the streets so that the UN will pick them up. I mean, that's very, very, very Haitian. They're just a very direct people. And you can see how aid workers or others that didn't have kind of connections with Haiti and didn't understand the culture would just be terrified about that. I think it's a real problem. I mean, I'll say that myself and my delegation, we were in, again, these neighborhoods of Cité Soleil and Bel Air. If people know who you are in those neighborhoods, they're really friendly. They're really happy that you're coming down to see how they live and their conditions, and they really want help. And you can also hear this from a lot of the independent journalists in Port-au-Prince. They're walking around. They're fine. They see that Haitians are doing their best to write in English on their houses. You know, someone's trapped here, or we need food, we need water. They're absolutely desperate for help. But this culture of security and red zone, this already existed before the earthquake. And, I mean, it's a very, very complex issue, but I think it has to do in part with just kind of a fear of the Haitian people, which is a real irony for organizations that claim to be going down to help Haiti. I mean, if you're not going to work closely with the Haitian poor, don't bother going down there, right? I mean, you're not there to help the people in the rich neighborhood of Petionville. So this security rhetoric is, I want to point out to people that it's not something new. And I think it's something that additionally is being exploited to justify bringing all these troops down to Haiti and achieve some other ends. But it is something that unfortunately, a lot of the NGOs in Haiti were perpetuating very, very needlessly. And I think it's something that really makes a lot of their work in Haiti rather useless, because they can't easily get out to help the people that they need to help. And that's, you know, that was the state before the earthquake. That's exactly what we're hearing now, that in the poor neighborhoods, they haven't seen anybody yet, and they're not getting any help. So this security issue, it's not the case that it reflects the actual danger of being in Haiti, because the Haitians are non-dangerous people. It reflects in part just the NGO working model of really not building connections in the poor neighborhoods and not learning to work with Haitian grassroots organizations. And then I think it also is being played up by the U.S. military and the Canadian military as an excuse to have the massive troop buildup in Haiti. So I think it's a twofold issue.
Aid has been implicated in destabilizing Haiti. Particularly, money has gone to aid organizations and instead of going to government infrastructure, etc. Can you comment on that?
Sure. Well, there's a couple ways that aid is destabilized Haiti. First, you know, when you call a group an NGO, you know, it's a non-governmental organization. I mean, that could be almost anything, right? And it does not specify the type of organization it is. And very literally, there was a really bad case that Canada funded of a so-called human rights organization in Haiti that's since been totally discredited, but basically invented and wrote a report about a supposed massacre in a part of Haiti and they blamed senior Lavalas officials for causing it. And as a result of that report, many of the Lavalas people were thrown in jail and kept there for years. And actually, that report has also been used to arrest former members of Lavalas coming into Canada. So that's an example. It's an unusual case, but that's an example of so-called aid money from Canada literally being used to destabilize Haiti. But the larger issue is you're right, these organizations, money flows to them and not to the Haitian state at all. And, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the existing Préval government, but even they have made several appeals to Hillary Clinton, to Bev Oda in Canada, saying, look, stop funding these NGOs, fund the Haitian state. One thing that funding NGOs does is just creates about 1,000 parallel bureaucracies. So your money doesn't even go very far because you're funding the bureaucracy of so many different NGOs rather than having a centralized education ministry being funded. I'll give you another example of the kind of attitude to the Haitian government versus the NGOs. The Swiss government recently decided to seize money that former dictator of Haiti, Jean Duvalier, the son of Papa Doc, had stolen from Haiti and put in a Swiss bank in the millions of dollars. The Swiss government said, well, we're going to seize this money and give it back to Haiti, but we're not going to give it to the Haitian government. We're going to give it to an NGO that we decide to pay. And so this aid issue is definitely used to disrespect the sovereignty of Haiti. So that's a very destabilizing influence as well. It just goes to fund these different NGOs. And another, you know, structural issue, but I think a lot of the NGO workers that I met certainly down there are good people who want to make a difference. But, you know, if you give, let's say, $100,000 to a Canadian NGO, you're paying international level wages. And NGO workers are not, you know, it's not like they're piling away loads of loot, but they get a salary, you know, just magnitudes higher than you would for paying a comparable Haitian official. So your money can never go as far. So what happens is the funding the NGOs just does not lead to any kind of durable state structures in Haiti. So that means when we see something like this earthquake, that there's really no infrastructure there to deal with anything. And the Haitian government is essentially totally collapsed. So I would say that funding NGOs, in some cases, does cause direct instability, but what it does is it leads to a very, very unstable and fragile state structure. And I think that's what we're seeing now after this earthquake.
Thanks, Stuart. We have about 15 more minutes that we can use. So I'm wondering if we can maybe switch topics a little and talk about the city of Jacmel, which is where Canadian forces, I believe, are being stationed, and also kind of like a main area in which you have a lot of Canadian capital being invested. I'm wondering if you could talk, and I believe you've also been to the city, have you not?
Yes, that's right. The delegation I was on, we spent about 4 days of a two-week delegation in Jacmel in the south.
So I'm wondering if you can elaborate on Canada's relationship with this particular city.
Sure. So Jacmel is a city that was also devastated by this earthquake. It's about a two-hour drive south of Port-au-Prince. And compared to Port-au-Prince, it's a city of about 40,000 people compared to the millions that live in Port-au-Prince. It looks extremely idyllic. It's right on the coast of the Caribbean, beautiful warm water. Deforestation, as a lot of people know, is a big problem in Haiti. It's a problem in Jacmel as well. I mean, the large trees are all gone, although there is a great deal of vegetation. So you see bananas and plantains and mango, you know, all these kind of trees there. So it's a very beautiful, idyllic place, and it's a place that the Haitian elite uses as a vacation spot. Had this earthquake not happened, Jacmel would very, very soon be hosting Haiti's massive carnival. The city swelled like three times its population during that period. And again, before this earthquake, a large hotel chain in the U.S., the Comfort Inn, had just said that they were going to reopen a hotel in Jacmel to kind of boost tourism again. So Jacmel is, and Jacmel is also the first place in Haiti, I believe in 1925, to get electricity. So it's somewhere that is a lot quieter than Port-au-Prince, as I was saying, extremely beautiful. And it's a place where people have tried to invest some capital. And apparently that has included Hydro-Québec, that built a kind of power station in Jacmel. And it's funny, when I was going down there, people said, oh, Jacmel, it's going to be great. You're going to have 24-hour power down there. Haiti's power grids are extremely erratic. A lot of people in houses, you have money, you have backup generators that have to sustain for most of the day when the power grid is down. And they said, oh, Jacmel is totally different. It's got a great road going into it. It's got 24-hour power. But when I got down there, the power was off for most of the day. The strength of the power grid and the Hydro-Québec power grid is greatly overstated. And I've read a little bit about this. I mean, people are very disappointed with the work that Hydro-Québec did. They built a little bit of infrastructure, but it's really not particularly reliable. So, you know, I should say, actually, maybe talk a little bit more about aid to Haiti, because this Hydro-Québec instance is probably just an example of what happens with a lot of aid to Haiti. And this is something I heard from a lot of Haitians, is that essentially a lot of aid is actually recycled back, the aid money is recycled back to the donor country. Probably, and I can't vouch this in the Hydro-Québec case, but probably a lot of the materials used to build that power generation station were probably bought in Canada. We heard that USAID, which is the U.S. equivalent of CETA, has a stipulation that 51% of materials donated to a given country have to be bought in the U.S. And you can imagine if you were going to, say, donate a truck to Haiti, well, you can't buy 49% of the truck in Haiti and 51% of it in the U.S. You buy the entire truck in the U.S. So the money for that truck is all going to come back to the U.S. And yes, Haiti gets the truck. But that's sort of the situation with a lot of the aid money is, you know, some stuff does get to Haiti, but a lot of the money gets recycled back to the donor country. Infrastructure, the materials are bought in the donor country. And I was just mentioning a little while ago the salary issue as well. Like, a lot of the money for salaries that basically just gets recycled back to the citizens of that country rather than staying in Haiti.
If this is the situation with aid going to Haiti, how would folks in Canada, or the U.S. even, support Haiti if they wanted to?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll answer it in two ways. First, in terms of the present crisis in Haiti, which is a really genuine one, it actually has been really wonderful to see people kind of open up and give to Haiti. You need to do some research into which organizations you're donating to. Questions have been raised recently, for example, about Wycliffe John's charity, as an example, it's being kind of really mired in corruption, and most of the money doesn't get to Haiti. One of the organizations that my group, Canada Haiti Action, is recommending is Partners in Health, which its Haiti operation is called Zami La Santé, which means Family Health. They've been in Haiti for 20 years, and what they actually do is their model is we're going to build a structure in Haiti, an organization rather in Haiti, that if all the Western people had to leave, that infrastructure would still essentially be in place. So they train Haitian community health workers. They also have Haitian doctors working down there. And also speak from personal experience. They're very, very willing to work with Haitian grassroots organizations, which is also very important. From Vancouver, we, with the Rotary Network here, sent a container of medical goods down to Haiti. And one thing we had to do is figure out how to get the shipment past customs. So we contacted Partners in Health and said, sure, we'll deal with the customs. And then we said, well, we wanted to get a lot of this aid to some grassroots groups in Haiti. We gave them a list, and they said, okay. And they got all that aid to those grassroots organizations. So in terms of immediate aid for this earthquake, I would really recommend a group like Partners in Health that just has a very, very different model, as a model that works with Haitian grassroots organizations and really builds up Haitian infrastructure. I mean, that's just extremely important. For the long term, that's far more difficult. I mean, that's something where you have to, I mean, the real future of Haiti lies in some grassroots, in the grassroots, building up Haiti again. And, I mean, certainly I think Canadians can play a valuable role if they keep an eye and put pressure on Canadian government and Canadian NGOs to play a good role in Haiti. I mean, that providing that kind of space for the Haitian people to organize and not be constantly destroyed by coups and other things, that is a very, very positive role Canadians can play. I mean, building up relationships with organizations in Haiti, obviously takes a lot more legwork and a lot more time. There are some. There's the Sophie Depp School in Port-au-Prince, which is run by a woman named Rhea Dole. I went down and visited it when I was there. It does amazing work, and she says that what she wants to do is provide an example of how to build a school in Haiti that other Haitians can follow. And indeed, I saw her down there. We met with a group of people in a slum called Jalousie, who were basically building a kind of a replica of her model school in their neighborhood. And that organization, SOPIDEP, is supported by the Sawatsky Family Foundation in Canada. You can look at the CanadaHaitiAction.ca website to read more about that. Jacques Mel also had a great organization that was running an experimental farm to do reforestation projects, and that was called Convict Pool IT, which means a kind of community work group for Haiti. And you can look at them at compay.org, which is compay.org. Another great Haitian grassroots organization. But not everyone has the time or capacity to build up those kind of connections with those kind of groups. So I would say that people listening, if they want to play a role in really aiding the grassroots in Haiti, it's to really put pressure on the Canadian side of things. Like, Canada's had such a dismal role in Haiti and played such a destabilizing influence that, putting pressure on Canada to stop destabilizing Haiti, I mean, that would be an extremely valuable contribution. I mean, I believe completely in the Haitians' ability to organize themselves. They've shown it time and time again, and they've been attacked time and time again for doing that. So if we can put pressure on our government to stop attacking Haiti, that's the best contribution that most Canadians can make, and I think the most appropriate one. But, you know, of course there are grassroots organizations you can build relationships with directly, but I think that, you know, we have the responsibility to put pressure on our own governments first to stop playing such a bad role in Haiti.
Is the, before I let you go, Stuart, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Well, yeah, I'd like to just say that, you know, I think I can certainly speak for my own organizing activities and those of my colleagues in Vancouver, and I think this is true across a lot of Canada. We've been kind of, feels like we've been banging our heads against the wall for a long time trying to get progressive people to notice Haiti and notice what's going on down there. It's been Canada's second largest foreign commitment after Afghanistan for the past 5 years, but it's one that's hardly ever talked about in the mainstream media, but also hardly ever talked about in the Canadian left. And I know that this has really started to change since this earthquake, and it's good to see that, and I'd like to encourage everybody to keep reading about Haiti, keep learning more about Haiti, because it's really a remarkable country, and if we can't, you know, we have to help, we have to help organize and make the lives better for people in Afghanistan and other countries, but Haiti is just so close to us and has such a remarkable history, and if we don't take the time to help that country, I don't know, I don't think we can really call ourselves progressive. So I invite everyone who's listening to take a look at CanadaHaitiAction.ca. That's got a lot of recent news posted about Haiti and about Canada and Haiti. And yeah, I encourage everyone to just keep paying attention and get involved.
Thanks for talking with me today, Stuart.
Okay, thanks, James.
And I'm going to let you go. Bye.
Thank you.